listening to the Hashtag STR Ask podcast from Stand to Reason. I'm Amy Hall, and Greg Kokel's here with me this morning, or this afternoon, or this evening, wherever you're listening. All right, Greg, this first question is another entry in the rutabagas are good category. It comes from Winnipeggers are the best.
Oh, must be a Canadian.
Yes. All right. So he has a series of questions that are all related. Here's what he asks. Will there be football in heaven? Will Russell Wilson throw interceptions there? Do our mistakes and fallibility in this world actually make it interesting? How will that change in the next? Four questions, but it's actually one. So to sum up, I think what he's asking is, will we be perfect or fallible? Is it our fallibilities that make life here interesting? What does this mean for heaven?
Yeah. Well, regarding the question of football in heaven, it depends what football one has in mind, because this word means different things in different parts of the globe. So if what one means is American football, which is, I think, what he is describing, the answer is yes. If what one means is all that silly kicking a ball around a field and chasing it back and forth and hammering their heads with it, no, I don't think there's going to be that. That's too silly for heaven. So, but the more basic question has to do, I think, with a game that has rules and practices that can be executed more effectively than others, all right? And what we will not have in heaven is evil, okay? If there are games in heaven, I don't have any reason to believe that there would be necessarily, but if there were games, then the games function like any game according to a set of rules. And it is possible to have some people do better at the game than others according to the rules that were made. And there are going to be faults, so to speak, in the playing of the game, but simply in virtue of the man-made rules. So if a pass is intercepted in heaven, that isn't a bad thing, not in a moral sense. It's just the way the game is played. So I don't think that what moral perfection means is that, or the perfection of heaven means, is that you are going to have perfect passers and perfect receivers on the offensive side and perfect defensive backs.
Because I didn't even know what would happen in the game if that were true.
Nothing would happen in the game. That's the point. Nothing would happen. But see, I think the problem here is the notion of perfection. We are importing all kinds of ideas into the idea of a perfect environment there that are not related to the notion of perfection that God has in mind. What we are going to have is moral perfection. All right. And that means we won't do anything wrong. We are going to have activities. And I just read yesterday, you are faithful in smaller things. This is Matthew 25. I will give you greater things to rule over. Enter into the joy of the Lord. So this is kind of a kingdom thing. And the one who doesn't do well, who hid the one talent, he's thrown out to the place with his wailing and gnashing of teeth. So this seems to be related to the afterlife. And we know that we are going to rule angels, all right? Well, how are we going to rule angels? Are they going to do bad things? Are we going to spank them or something? There are different aspects to ruling. There's going to be organized things happening, and we're going to oversee things. And both the comment about ruling angels in 1 Corinthians 4 or wherever that shows up, and the comment there in Matthew 25, I think, where it talks about, I will give you greater things to rule over. These all seem to relate to meaningful activities in the kingdom in which people are doing meaningful things and exercising authority. But it's not an area where there's going to be any harm or wrongdoing. But the fact that there's no harm or wrongdoing does not mean there's no meaningful activity. There was no sin in the garden, but Adam and Eve were said told to be fruitful, multiply, subdue. There are all kinds of things they could do without sinning. Now, whether I joked earlier about football or football, you know, and I have no idea what the activities of heaven are going to be like, nor does anyone else. It's just not clear. There are references to the quality of life in heaven, and that's what I focused in on at the end of the story of reality. The quality, being with our loved ones who know the Lord, being completely cleansed and personally pure and untainted by sin. Nobody has ever experienced what that feels like except for Jesus, all right? Being without any worry at all, without any threat, without any hostility towards anyone, no anguish, nothing to cause us to weep. This is a quality of life that's ahead of us. It's what our hearts have always yearned for, and Lewis said it so well. The door that we've been knocking on all of our lives will finally open. I wish I would have written that line. I did put it in the book, but I had to put C.S. Lewis at the footnote. But this was a wonderful insight. I can hardly, when I give my teaching on the story of reality, and I end with that point, I get choked up a lot of times because this is the existential human condition. We know we are made for something greater than what we experience, and we are longing, longing, longing for that. And this idea of longing is a huge part of Lewis's work. And what he says is that longing will come to an end. We will be satisfied. That we know. Now, what we're going to do with all the time we have, and there will be time in heaven because things will be happening. We will still have an age. We just won't die. We won't live we will live forever, but we won't live in eternity. We just get older and older and older.
And there will be a new earth. So in some sense, there will be things very similar to what we're doing now, I would guess.
Right. Yes, I agree too. I think and this is where this is going to be our abode. We're not going to be locked up in heaven, locked in a beatific gaze, a locked gaze on a beatific vision, looking at God forever, like where everybody's frozen looking at the glory. That is not the picture that we get. So anyway, but whatever it is, it's good. It's a weight of glory that we will experience, that everything that negative we experience in this life will be modest by comparison to the goodness. 2 Corinthians 4:16 through 18, weight of glory.
And I'll also say, I don't think we will all be the same. I think we will still have different abilities and gifts, and we will still contribute different things to the community, because we will be in community with each other. We will be contributing to that, just as he wanted Adam and Eve to create a civilization where they were
right,
growing things and building things and contributing different things.
And so Amy will not be harassing me about commas.
Because you'll always get the commas right, Greg. No, actually, the second thing I was going to say is I don't think we will have perfect abilities. I think we'll still be limited creatures. So you can still drop the ball. You can still someone could be better at something than you are. I don't think our limitations will change. I think maybe we can probably grow and learn new things and develop things, but we'll always be limited. We'll never be God. So in that sense, I think you could play a game. Mm-hmm. It does seem like you could, but again, Greg, it does seem like if there's no crying, there can't be soccer, because what will happen if someone gets hit in the head? I'm sorry, soccer fans.
There you go. See.
I know there are people outside of America listening to this, so I apologize. All right. Let's go on to the next question. This one comes from Caleb. Cosmic trolley problem. Would a perfectly good God permit the eternal death of many people without the chance for faith in Christ? Are they the collateral damage in the best of all possible worlds where the most people freely choose the path to eternal life with Christ?
Well, this question makes a presumption, and it also asks a question that is hard to answer because only God knows the answer to it. The presumption it makes is that what God is most concerned about is getting the most people into heaven. That is his chief concern. I'm not convinced that is his chief concern. Now, I think I'm fairly representing somebody like William Lane Craig, who makes that statement many times, that he thinks what God is most interested in, and why not, he would say, is to get the most people into heaven as possible who freely choose him. Okay? I have no criticism, in a sense. I don't think that's the calculus, personally, but a lot of people do. And Bill's an example. It may be that God has a different goal. And consequently, the different goal is going to shed whatever one understands the goal to be is going to inform the question that was just asked. Clearly, multitudes are going to spend eternity without God, and many are going to be in heaven with God. So there's good and there's bad, I mean, by our assessment, all right? And somebody's saying, what can justify the bad compared to the good? And my answer is, none of us are in a position to make that assessment. We don't know how many go to hell. We don't know how many go to heaven. And we don't know what God's purpose is across the board for all of this system, ultimately, because God hasn't told us that. Now, we might presume it's to get most people into heaven. It's curious, even with that view that Bill has, and a lot of people hold that view, he doesn't see any difficulty with the number of people who freely choose not to turn to God. They will be punished appropriately. He's not troubled by that equation, even though that's his general view about God. I don't know how he would answer it specifically. Well, here's the rationale behind it. Here is the justification. But he does make the point that there are all kinds of things, and when he deals with the problem of evil, there are all kinds of things that we see as evils now that could possibly have tremendous ramifications for a more significant good in the future. And sometimes we are able to see that as we look back. But sometimes that good may be years or centuries down the line, the good that is accomplished by the bad that God allowed, and the good justifies the allowing of the bad, the balance tips. But we have to, the only one that could understand that clearly is God himself, who sees everything as they are and all the consequences of everything. So I think the question in itself can't be answered, because no matter what one thinks the basic purpose of people on earth is in God's plan, it can't be answered, I or nay, because we don't see enough to be able to answer it. And secondly, a lot depends on what you consider to be the chief good of all of this, and that also is a matter of debate. Different people are going to answer it in different ways.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there is any collateral damage, because I think God is free to save anyone he chooses and to bring that about in the way that he chooses. So I do not believe there's collateral damage. I believe there's purpose in everything that God sovereignly decrees in this world. And I think, and I agree with you, Greg, there are different ideas of what it means to be a best possible world and what God's goal is. And I firmly believe that his goal is the glory of his grace.
To manifest his glory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And in particular, his grace, and above even every other way of seeing mm-hmm. him. But and if you just look at, I know I've mentioned this verse before, but in Romans 9, you know, I think there's even a purpose for people being punished in hell. I don't think that is an accident or a any sort of collateral damage. I think it's actually there to reveal things about God to his people, to reveal his justice, to reveal his righteousness, to reveal his wrath so that his people understand the, I mean, right now, ununderstandable grace that he's offered us. We don't understand the grace that's been given to us because we don't understand our own sin. Mm-hmm. So even the little bit that we understand does not do justice to the weight of God's, mm-hmm. of the glory of his grace.
It's another way of kind of saying that good news is not good news without the bad news. There's a contrast here. We see the those punished justly for their rebellion and those not punished in virtue of a grace that is so great that it cancels out the punishment. It is something other than the punishment we ought to have received, yet it is a punishment that Jesus took upon himself.
And even the bad news for people going to hell, I mean, from their perspective, that's bad news. But even in that case, justice is good. God is a good judge. Even that justice is a good thing. It upholds his righteousness. It shows his righteousness. And we are looking at that from the perspective of people who are suffering the judgment. But in reality, objectively, that justice is a good thing. So none of this is collateral damage. It's all serving a purpose that God has, and we get hints of that throughout the Bible. But the passage in Romans 9 is where he says, he talks about how he raised up Pharaoh in order to demonstrate his power through that situation. And then at the end, Paul says, what if God, willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, and he did so to make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he also called not from among Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles.
Yeah.
So there's an example of there being a purpose. There is a purpose that all of this is happening. So I reject the idea that there's any collateral damage.
Interesting. So it isn't the balance of the good outweighs the balance of the bad. Your point, and I tend to agree with you here, is the bad isn't bad. It is subjectively bad for those who are punished for what they did wrong. But it is a good thing because God is manifesting his glory on the one hand in his justice and judgment, and on the other hand in his grace. Mm-hmm. In both cases, God's glory is manifested.
It's a difficult topic, obviously, and like you mentioned, Greg, people have very different views on this. So this is the view I defend, and so there are other people who have other views. So mm-hmm. you can consider the passages, and we've talked about this many times on the show.
Yeah,
go back and look at those also. Let's squeeze one more in here. This one comes from I'm trying to
this usually doesn't end well, Amy.
I know.
That means another
I know,
10 or 15 minutes of conversation. All right, let's give it a shot.
Okay, this one comes from Anonymous. Is a change in one's theology sufficient grounds for seeking a new church home? I've been attending a non-denominational church since leaving Catholicism 5 years ago. They land more on the Pentecostal, charismatic Arminian side of the spectrum, whereas now I align with the Reformed Presbyterian side. I know we aren't supposed to divide as brethren over this issue, but I feel burdened with a sense of inconsistency.
This is fairly simple to answer. The answer is, of course you can change churches. This isn't a divide. One is not dividing. One is simply pursuing a church home in a way that they can be fed consistently with their own convictions about Scripture. If you're Reformed, you're going to be frustrated at a Pentecostal church who are Arminian, and there's all kinds of other things that are part of the culture that aren't good or bad, they're just different, that are probably going to make someone with the Reformed sensibilities a little bit more uncomfortable, and vice versa, all right? So if your theology changes, then it's certainly legitimate to be able to change your local church, especially if it changes significantly. If, however, the difference in your theology is modest and minor and somewhat inconsequential in the big picture, then there's no need to move, though you may want to move to some place where your theology is just more in line with the people. It's a community. If you feel like you're strongly attached to a community of Christians that you largely agree with and the pastor and respect, no problem. If you don't largely agree with them and or you don't respect the leadership for some reason, it's definitely time to move somewhere else instead of sitting in the pew or the chair wherever every week being critical. And going to a new place could result in a lot more comfort, a lot more pleasure in worship, enjoyment in community, and better feeding in light of what you understand the scriptures actually to be teaching.
Yeah, I agree with you, Greg. If it's something this significant, I don't think it's illegitimate to change your church. I know it's hard. It's always hard when you have to start over and you have to find a new congregation and join in with them. But also, his conversion was only 5 years ago. So he hasn't been there too long. It would be a good idea now. It's a better idea to switch now to your convictions than to wait longer, because it's always hard to build up a new community. All right. Thank you, Greg. We did that one in just a couple of minutes.
Hey.
It's a record. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for your questions. Send those to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRask, or you can go on our website, go to our contact page, choose I have another question, and then just make sure you have hashtag STRask. Otherwise, I won't know which show you're sending it for, and it might not get into the right folder. So make sure you put hashtag STRask, all one word. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Thanks for listening.